Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Anne Ball and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, a group of Spanish fishermen will receive financial support to catch plastic as well as fish. It is part of a new project aimed at fighting the huge amount of waste left in the world's oceans. About 12 billion tons of plastic waste are entering the oceans every year. This garbage pollutes the water, kills wildlife, and breaks down into small particles called microplastics that fish and other creatures eat. Carlos Martin is one of the fishermen taking part in the project. Martin is captain of the Bonamar II, a boat based at the Spanish port of Barcelona. VOA joined him and his crew early one morning as they began removing pieces of plastic from their fishing nets. Martin blames rivers for carrying a lot of plastic to the sea. Martin says he and his crew collect the solid plastic and bring it back to land. He adds that wood-based cellulose plastic often gets caught in the nets. He says, the net does not function properly in relation to its height in the water, and it takes on mud, causing the net to break because it weighs so much. Under the new programs, 1 million euros of taxpayers' money will support ocean cleanup efforts for fishermen like Martin. The money is coming from the European Union and the Catalan government. Sergi Tudela, the general director of Catalonia Fisheries, is supervising the cleanup project.
With these funds, they can improve what they need to carry on board, the boxes or all the facilities they need to cope with the problem. We are hopeful that if we are successful in this project, right, that this project could be replicated in other areas in the Mediterranean.
Government reports say that the amount of plastic waste washing up along the Spanish coastline has grown by 65% in just 6 years. Martin says the fishing community now understands how big the problem is. He says, before we didn't see it that way. We took it and threw it back into the water. We had no conscience. I think that a few years here we have become very aware. Nothing is thrown into the water. We collect everything and bring it to shore. Fishing equipment makes up a large part of the estimated 8 to 12 million tons of plastic left in the world's oceans every year. Martin and his fishing community look to become part of the international effort to clean up the oceans.
Tene Kanate's family cannot believe
how she earns a living. She drives a huge truck around the Houndé gold mine in Burkina Faso. The 42-year-old single mother is one of 111 women working at the mine. Most of them were trained for jobs that more traditionally would go to men in West Africa. These jobs include carrying rubble, blasting and breaking up rocks, or driving heavy vehicles. Konate and the other women are helped by a worldwide effort of mining companies to bring more women into the industry. The industry has been slow to balance the number of male and female employees, and women remain greatly outnumbered by men. At Houndé, they make up just 11% of the workers. Canada's Endeavour Mining runs the Houndé mine. After separating from her husband, Konate struggled to provide for her two young daughters. She took jobs cleaning houses, cooking, and mixing material used for buildings. When she heard the mine was hiring, she traveled across the country by bus for an interview. Today, Konate lives in a large house in Houndé. She is able to pay for her daughter's schooling. "The mine has changed everything in my life," she said. "Everything." She said that at this time in her life, "I really don't need a man to do everything for me." Many women in Burkina Faso face barriers to finding well-paid, skilled work. They also lack financial independence because more than half of women in the country marry before they turn 18. Konate's first job at the mine was gathering waste. She was later trained to operate the trucks. The vehicle's wheels are so big that drivers must climb a ladder to get into the driver's seat. "The fact that it is a man's job and that I can do it, really, I like that very, very, very much," she said. Family and friends respect what she has done. Others find it hard to believe. "I told my uncle, 'Yeah, I really drive that machine.' Honestly, he was very, very, very surprised to see I was doing that." Sonia Nkima oversees the work of more than 100 people at the mine pit. She said women sometimes face pushback or problems from the men. But she tells people around her to forget about the differences between men and women, and instead judge people based on the quality of their work. "I always say to my operators, as soon as you cross that gate, we are no longer women," Nkima said. "We wear the same trousers as you do. We have become men because we do the same job." I'm Anne Ball.
If you have always wanted to become an astronaut, now could be your chance. For the first time in more than 4 years, the U.S. space agency NASA is seeking candidates to be future astronauts. The search comes after NASA announced plans to send the first woman and the next man to the moon as part of its Artemis program. Artemis aims to return humans to the moon by 2024. NASA's next goal is to establish a long-term base on the moon by 2028. From there, NASA says it will be able to launch regular space operations, including missions to Mars. NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine said these plans present a growing need to choose and train future space explorers. America is closer than any other time in history since the Apollo program to returning astronauts to the moon, Bridenstine said. We will send the first woman and next man to the lunar South Pole by 2024, and we need more astronauts to follow suit on the moon and then Mars, he said. Bridenstine added, if you have always dreamed of being an astronaut, apply now. NASA says it expects to choose the final candidates in the middle of 2021. They will then immediately begin training to become Artemis Generation astronauts. NASA says it currently has 48 active astronauts. The last time it sought new candidates was in late 2015. At that time, a record-breaking 18,300 people applied. 11 of them were chosen to become NASA astronauts. After going through an intensive training program, the astronauts officially graduated in January. So what exactly is NASA looking for in its crew of new astronauts? Two general requirements are that applicants must be U.S. citizens and hold a master's degree in a field related to science, technology, engineering, or mathematics, or STEM. This master's requirement can also be met with the completion of at least 2 years of a STEM PhD program or by finishing a test pilot school program. A medical degree will also be accepted. In addition, candidates must also have at least 2 years of professional experience in their field. Or, in the case of pilots, candidates need at least 1,000 hours of pilot-in-command flying time. Of course, all applicants will have to complete a NASA physical examination to test their fitness for long-term spaceflight. The positions are based in Houston, Texas, headquarters of the Johnson Space Center. However, applicants must also be willing to live and work at 400 kilometers above Earth during possible stays at the International Space Station. And, for the first time, all candidates will also need to take an internet-based test. The pay for a beginning astronaut is officially listed at between $105,000 and $161,000 a year. In a NASA video, some current astronauts explain what they think it takes to succeed at the job. Warren Hoberg identifies three important areas.
The three things that it takes to be an astronaut are technical skill, operational skills, and then just being fun and easy to be around.
Matthew Dominic noted the necessity of being able to fix things that break down.
If you were to boil it down to something simple, I would say we're all mechanics. It's just really, really hard to get to the worksite.
And Frank Rubio gives candidates a highly practical suggestion.
It would probably not be great if you were scared of tight spaces.
The astronaut application process will continue through March 31st. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Growing tensions in Europe and Asia created a serious conflict for Americans during the 1930s. Most Americans opposed the fascist or military leaders gaining control in Germany, Italy, Japan, and other countries. But they were not willing to take any firm action to stop this growing movement. Americans did not want to become involved in another world war, and they called on President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and their representatives in Congress to remain neutral in world affairs. But aggression by Germany and Japan finally would force Americans to choose between their love of democracy and their desire for peace. The first challenge to America's policy of neutrality came in October 1935. Troops from fascist Italy invaded Ethiopia. Roosevelt did not feel neutral at all. He told his advisors, "Italy is dropping bombs on Ethiopia, and that is war." He sharply criticized the fascist Italian leader Benito Mussolini. Roosevelt issued an order banning Americans from sending arms to either Italy or Ethiopia, and he called on Americans not to send oil or other materials to Italy. Roosevelt's efforts to stop the export of oil and other products did not succeed. But the efforts by the White House played an important part in leading the League of Nations to take economic actions against Italy. Less than 2 years later, civil war broke out in Spain. Spanish fascists led by General Francisco Franco tried to overthrow the democratic government in Madrid. Some Americans went to join the Democratic Army in Spain to fight Franco. But Roosevelt and the Congress agreed that America should remain officially neutral in the conflict. In this way, Roosevelt was meeting the wishes of the American people by avoiding war. But personally, he was deeply troubled by the events in Europe. In a letter to his ambassador in France, Roosevelt wrote, "One cannot help feeling that the whole European situation is blacker than at any time in your lifetime or mine." Another challenge to American neutrality came in Asia. Japan launched a new invasion of China in July 1937. Within 1 month, Japanese forces gained control of what was then called Peking, now Beijing, and Tianjin. The United States had long supported the nationalist forces of China, and many Americans were angry about the Japanese invasion. But Roosevelt and his administration once again refused to take strong actions against the aggression. For one thing, the American Navy was weak. There was little it could do to stop Japanese aggression thousands of miles away in Asia. And neither Roosevelt nor the Congress wanted to be the first to break America's official policy of neutrality. Franklin Roosevelt made clear in private talks with friends that he understood the serious threat to world peace created by Adolf Hitler and other fascists. He believed that the United States could not remain neutral forever
if democracy was threatened in so many countries. However, Roosevelt did little to educate the nation about this threat. Instead, he generally followed the wishes of the majority of people who wanted America to remain neutral. Public opinion in the United States was strongly against any kind of involvement in foreign conflicts. In 1937, Roosevelt made an important speech calling for the world's neutral nations to protect themselves from lawless fascist nations. But many Americans feared that Roosevelt was trying to create a new alliance, and they opposed his efforts. A public opinion survey at the time showed that less than one in three Americans was willing to change the nation's strong neutrality laws to give Roosevelt more freedom of action. In the same year, Japanese planes sank an American gunboat in the Yangtze River in China. But few Americans showed any interest in going to war over the incident. Instead, they accepted Japanese apologies. Americans simply had no desire to fight. Most Americans honestly believed that the best hope for their country was neutrality. One of the most influential supporters of neutrality was Senator Gerald Nye of North Dakota. He told the New York Times in 1937 that there can be no objection to any action the government may take which tries to bring peace to the world. But that action, he added, must not tie the American people into another world death march. He said, "I very much fear that we are once again being caused to feel that the call is upon America to police a world that chooses to follow insane leaders." Adolf Hitler's Nazi forces moved into the Rhineland in 1936. 2 years later, they invaded Austria. And then, in the following months, Hitler began making demands on the government of Czechoslovakia. Britain's Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain was afraid that Hitler might start a general European war if he was blocked from gaining control of Czechoslovakia. In September of 1938, Chamberlain traveled to Munich to discuss the situation with the German leader. The result was that Britain agreed to a German takeover of Czechoslovakia. Chamberlain returned to London, promising peace in our time.
The settlement of the Czechoslovakian problem, which has now been achieved, is, in my view, only the prelude to a larger settlement in which all Europe may find peace. This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler. And here is the paper which bears his name upon it as well as mine. Some of you perhaps have already heard what it contains, but I would just like to read it to you. We, the German Führer and Chancellor, and the British Prime Minister have had a further meeting today and are agreed in recognizing that the question of Anglo-German relations is of the first importance for the two countries and for Europe. We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again.
The first reaction of most Americans to Chamberlain's Munich agreement was one of relief. But then public opinion changed. Americans saw that Hitler's Germany now had control of Central Europe. Japan was becoming more powerful in Asia. Chamberlain's weakness only served to show dictators that they could gain land and power through aggression and fear. Roosevelt warned Americans in late 1938 about this fascist threat. "There can be no peace," he said, "if another nation makes the threat of war its national policy."
There can be no peace if national policy adopts as a deliberate instrument the threat of war. There can be no peace if national policy adopts as a deliberate instrument the dispersion all over the world of millions of helpless and persecuted wanderers with no place to lay their heads. There can be no peace if humble men and women are not free to think their own thoughts, to express their own feelings, and to worship God. There can be no peace if economic resources that ought to be devoted to social and economic reconstruction are to be diverted to an intensified competition in armaments.
Roosevelt and much of the American public continued to hope that the United States could stay out of foreign conflicts. But increasingly they understood that war might come, and they began to prepare for possible hostilities. Following the Munich Agreement, Roosevelt requested a large increase in the defense budget. He asked Britain and France to buy arms from American manufacturers to give those companies more experience in producing weapons. And he helped bring about an agreement among nations in North and South America to join together to oppose fascist threats to peace and security. Finally, Roosevelt tried to get Congress to change the neutrality laws. He wanted more freedom as president to resist fascist aggression and help Britain, France, China, and other friendly nations. Congress, however, continued to resist such changes. But events in early 1939 showed that war was on the way. Germany occupied Czechoslovakia and then Lithuania. Franco's forces took control in Spain. Italy invaded Albania. And then Hitler began making demands on Poland. In August, Germany and the Soviet Union announced to the world that they had signed a non-aggression agreement. A week later, Germany attacked Poland. Two days later, Britain and France declared war on Germany. Germany's invasion of Poland and the beginning of the war presented a giant challenge to the United States. On the one hand, almost all Americans supported the European democracies opposing the aggression by Hitler, Mussolini, and other fascists. But on the other hand, Americans had no desire to fight in what might be a long and bloody war. The following months would force Americans of all political beliefs to consider this problem. It would be a final period of peace for the United States before events once again drew it into a terrible world conflict.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.